Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC as we take a look back across 2 days of Champions League action. The first of those playoff rounds, the first legs of those games. We're into a new era in the Champions League. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today, and joining me across the water in rainy San Diego is Mr. Dean Jones.
Yes, mate. Hello. A rainy day in Southern California. Not had any of these, maybe, since I landed 7 months ago. It's quite nice, to be honest. I just said to you then, I went for a walk, put my coat on, hood up, AirPods in, loaded up Global Player and started listening to Heart Radio, like I was back in England.
Well, right at home, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of Gloria Estefan was playing as I was going on my walk and listening to the traffic updates from probably your neck of the woods, to be honest. So that was fun. I felt at home for a little walk. That was just before settling down for the Champions League. It's a wet for a few days. I mean, it's been talked about in the news as the storm. I mean,
it's a bit of rain.
It's a bit wet. This isn't the storm, but I mean, by San Diego standards, fair enough. Like, this is probably as stormy as we're going to see for a while. But
I can't believe you've seen rain for the first time 7 months after arriving. It really made me laugh when you saw that. I thought, we haven't had this. Every time I've come to you, I've gone, sunny San Diego, sunny San Diego. You're like, it's raining. I was like, wow, we really do get to mix it up.
Really raining, yeah. Like all a full day of it. I mean, we've had spurts of like 5 minutes here and there, but yeah, this is literally, I send my videos to my friends saying, I feel like I'm back in England, lads. Look at me. I quite liked it. It was quite comforting. And felt
it's
right.
It's okay for a couple of days. It's not when it's been the last 7 months.
Yeah, that's it. That's the flip side. Right? After these 3 days, it'll be back to being be sunny and I'll have my shorts back on. It felt good in a Champions League week. Obviously, when you... a lot of the games I've watched actually have been in the rain, so it felt quite fitting. Felt very English. It was nice.
Indeed. Right, so we're going to start with Tuesday's action. The headline tie of the week obviously happened on Tuesday with Manchester City hosting Real Madrid. And a wonderful game it was too for the neutral, I would say. A less wonderful game for Pep Guardiola and for the Manchester City players who afterwards in the interviews looked genuinely devastated. Two late goals from Real Madrid turning that tie around. City dropping more, I was going to say points, obviously not points, but dropping another winning position this season. They've now conceded 20 goals, Dean, after the 75th minute mark this season already in 38 games. That is absurd. They've also lost games from winning positions 5 times this season, which is more than the last 3 seasons combined for Manchester City. Yeah. It really, really isn't looking pretty. Although it started with Real Madrid in the ascendancy and City started to grow into the game. And the frustrating element for a lot of this is that I think over the course of it, if you take sort of, I don't know, let's say the 60 minutes between the 15-minute mark and the 75-minute mark, it was one of City's best performances of the season.
Yeah, they played all right for a large part of it, but that's not really okay that's how we're now judging this team. They played well for about an hour. Great, you're Man City and you're one of the most expensively built teams ever. You should be good for an hour.
So one of the most dominant teams ever, especially in England.
Yeah, when you talk about the kind of the notable losses, I mean, at the moment, this one feels like it's really rocked the fan base, to be honest, because I don't think it's because you can't handle losing to Real Madrid. I think that it's because it's so momentous in terms of you might now be out of the Champions League. And it was a moment when it was starting to look like City were matching one of the best teams in Europe, and that's where they expect their team to be. So it was, I don't think it's as bad as when they lost to PSG and like completely completely lost their way, conceding all of those goals late on. But when you consider, like, wasn't that long ago, the 2-2 draw at Brentford, which was bad, and then the 2-1 loss to Man United, which was bad. I still think probably the worst moment of the season was the 3-3 with Feyenoord, because I think that, like, it's all summed up in that game, and that moment kind of encapsulates all of the problems. But yeah, ultimately, this is a result that really seems to have affected everybody. Now, I want to say that I'm being a bit careful, actually, how I judge it. Since I've been thinking of it, obviously, we've had more time to absorb, like, what happened here. And one thing that I've been thinking about is, like, City might be, like, their own worst enemy here in terms of, like, all the success that they've had. Because, like I was just saying then, like, we have such high expectations of them. They have high expectations of themselves. But we've never seen a team that's won 4 Premier League titles in a row, right? So maybe this is what happens if you do. Because the longer you keep winning Premier League titles, I think it must become harder and harder to change up the squad and to move on players that are probably past it. And in a fixture like this, when you've got somebody like KDB out there, who's clearly not at his best anymore, like, I think at this level he's probably done from the evidence that we have in front of us recently. I don't think he'd still be here if they hadn't won the league last season. I feel like we'd have seen more change, and I don't think we'd have seen such an intense drop-off. So it's a very strange way to look at it, because obviously you want that Premier League title, you're not going to change that. But I do think it's made it harder for City to be progressive in terms of the squad overhaul, which they've obviously tried to do last month, because they suddenly realised that that was the mess that they were in and that they should have moved earlier in the market.
None of the players that they bought in January started this game, right? So it's probably worth pointing that out.
So none of the new additions that they just made played in this game. And I could understand the reasoning for that, though, because what Pep Guardiola will be trying to do here is pick players that he knows inside out and trusts for the occasion. And I think he would have felt personally a sense of vulnerability of fielding players that he doesn't know well enough for how they'll deal with an occasion like this. And that he's only known for a matter of weeks rather than a number of years. So I could actually understand why he would go for this lineup. And to be honest, like, Marmoush, for example, I don't think actually, apart from his debut when I thought Marmoush looked really bright, I don't think Marmoush has actually been great. And I think that I don't blame him for not starting him in this game. I'm surprised he probably didn't. Am I surprised he didn't come on earlier? Maybe. But I think that Pep just has to work out who he can trust. And the problem is he reverts back to and ends up with Kovacic and Gundogan back on the pitch and Rico Lewis back on there, and he's having to bring Phil Foden
on. His hand was a little bit forced with the Rico Lewis thing. Obviously, Manuel Akanji picked up an injury, and that really did slightly turn the tide of things, I think, with Vinicius, because whilst obviously Vinicius can get the better of any fullback in the game, I think that with Manuel Akanji out there, you have sort of the physicality to be able to kind of match him stride for stride at times. It just kept him a little bit quieter. As soon as it was Rico Lewis, you're like, ooh, this could get ugly. And not because Rico Lewis isn't a fantastic football player, but because at right back, he looks a little bit physically outmatched at times. And I think that's what happened. Obviously happens for the final goal, but it was happening, you know, before that as well.
I mean, Rico Lewis had a poor season. And it was obviously, I had some sympathy for him being the one that is caught out in that situation.
It's a terrible pass from Kovacic as well. Like, there's not very much that City do right in that period. And look, we could analyse all of these goals, and there are positives for City, because I want to talk about John Stones, and I want to talk about the fact that Erling Haaland scored twice, and the penalty was incredibly composed, I thought, considering he's missed one recently for Manchester City and that he hadn't scored against Real Madrid before Tuesday night. It did kind of feel like, okay, that's a moment, and you can kind of hang on to those things. And the way that he got about his business and got at those City centre-backs, which we said before the game was potentially something that City could look to exploit, you know, that all felt kind of reasonable, I think, in some ways. But at the end of things, you know, at 2-1 up with 10 minutes to play, City become their own worst enemy. Edison plays a terrible ball out for obviously ends up with the equaliser from Brahim Diaz. And then everyone is all over the place for the final goal. And at some point, you know, obviously you mentioned that stat about goals from the 75th minute onwards, etc. But is this becoming now a mental thing? Is it a mental block that City don't believe from their own positions of power that they are going to see out games in a way that they just executed time and time and time again over the last couple of years?
The players themselves have already kind of admitted that in interviews that it is. And it's hard not for that to be the case when you've got a full stadium of people who, as soon as the going gets tough, feel like the inevitable is now going to happen and you're going to crumble. Now, pretty crazy that City have come to that mentality in the space of like 6 months or whatever. But that is where we are at. I just think that there are problems like, okay, so City, we talk about, like, they've got a problem at right back. They've had it for a while, right? And whether you decide to put Ake there or Akanji there, or if you're going to play Rico Lewis there or Mateus Nunez there, right? None of it really works. Yeah, what if Real Madrid have a problem for this game? They didn't have a right back. What'd they do? They came up with a solution, and it worked really well.
I mean, they've come up with that solution, you know, over a number of weeks. And also, there is so much depth in the Real Madrid midfield that you can afford to move, you know, in my opinion, as I've said before, the best centre midfielder in the world to right back in order to do a job.
I think they missed him in the middle, though. They did still miss him.
They do miss him, but not to the extent that City are missing players in that midfield, right? And actually, do you know who I think would have been the best player to have put a right back in that situation? Probably John Stones. But he moves into the defensive midfield role, which a lot of us have been crying out for from Pep for quite a while. You know, you go back and listen to the Truth episode before Christmas about where City were in that post-Rodri era and be like, why is he not playing John Stones in that role that we've seen him play really well? And I thought Stones was excellent in that role, but he can't be in two places at once.
No, and I think fitness is difficult for John Stones when he plays that role, because he's had so many problems with injuries and stuff. And I think that you're just in more danger there of putting yourself into the red zone and then picking up a muscle injury. And that's one thing they've got to really carefully manage with John Stones. He was definitely, from my perspective, their best player on the night. And I know that at the moment they've got a decision to make on Stones as to whether they end up handing him a new contract and what the terms of that are. I would say, just alone and watching him play that position against Real Madrid, I would give him a new contract, because in this period where, you know, Gundogan's not up to it, Kovacic ain't up to it, you know, Nico Gonzalez, I know he was on the bench for this one and people were like, why is he not playing? He did have a knock and stuff, like he wasn't fully fit. So I think that there's some conditioning to be done there still. I think I would expect John Stones actually to get a new contract. But yeah, Valverde, I think, did really well for Real Madrid. And
He always plays well.
Like, he always does well.
I remember the last
time
I saw him play have a bad game.
Yeah, and I think the fact that they could trust him to go there and play that role that well was key to the way that Madrid could keep themselves in the game, really. When you, though, consider now the second leg, because that's what it comes down to, I mean, City 2, Real Madrid 3, it was a fantastic tie, don't get me wrong. And actually, it was the first time I've sat there thinking, wow, I love this new format of the Champions League. They've absolutely nailed it, because here I am halfway through a season watching a game between these two teams, which could quite easily be the final. But we're
it
just
is funny though, this is proper
night.
Not supposed to happen stuff, isn't it? You're like, these two were not supposed to be in that 9-24 range. But I mean, it does throw up surprises, and it was always going to throw up some surprises. It was always going to throw up some really interesting ties. So I think that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just to kind of address something slightly more lighthearted, there was a lot of debate online about this whole City banner that they raised before kickoff with Rodri holding the Ballon d'Or and the old Oasis lyrics of "Stop crying your heart out." I've got to say, I thought it was hilarious. Now, there is obviously an element of don't poke the bear, because Vinicius Jr. took one look at it and then dropped a man of the match performance and supplied the assist for the winner. And, you know, that's all part of it. But I can't in good faith have sat here and defended I was like, well, what, you know, what we would determine as maybe shithousery from players, and then turn at that and be like, no, that's ridiculous from fans. You've got to enjoy it. You've got to give a bit of grief. Look, I was quite vehement in the viewpoint that I think it was ridiculous. Even if you believe that Vinicius Jr. deserved to win the Ballon d'Or, there was not much between those two players who play completely different roles. And like boycotting the ceremony because you thought that it was unfair is absolutely ludicrous. Mm. So if that happens, I feel like you have the prerogative to go and take the mick out of it. Yes, it backfired, but I think that shouldn't take away from the fact that it was quite a funny banner, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, they've got the whole Oasis theme going on at the moment, which they seem to be buying into. They've got the...
That picture of Rodri, by the way, doing the Liam Gallagher pose might be the worst thing I've ever seen. So
yeah,
that
there's some bad stuff, but like this Rodri t-shirt saying slide away and all this sort of stuff. And fair enough, you know, City, obviously a big part of Manchester City culture and all of that. I just feel this team they're not really good enough to be able to make fun of Real Madrid at the moment. And it did backfire. And as we move now into the game at the Bernabeu, and because, you know, defensively, both these teams have got flaws and you fancy that you could always see either of these teams conceding, obviously. And even though City have been undone by two individual errors on their own behalf, like what Edison's doing on his part, you know, with the pass and the...
He'd actually been quite good up to that point.
Yeah,
as well,
he's been fine, but my goalkeeper's had a brain fart and then Rico Lewis has just been overpowered, basically. And it's gone. You've lost that momentum, and it's obviously a huge shift in momentum. But it comes down to what happens in the second leg and who can you trust to score. Would you be back in Vinicius Jr., Bellingham, Rodrigo and Mbappe? Or would you be on Haaland, Savinho, Grealish, Phil Foden?
Jack was a bit unfortunate last night as well in terms of picking up an injury.
He was
doing okay, but lovely ball in that
right.
Obviously led to the first goal. He picks up a knock and just feels like any momentum keeps getting stalled by a variety of different things, whether that's self-error, whether that's injury. Like, again, it feels like one of those where it would be ridiculous, given the concerns that Real Madrid have from a defensive perspective, to completely and utterly write City out of this. And maybe they'll drop one of their best performances when nobody expects them to. But equally, I think you'd find long, long odds on City qualifying for the next round now at this point. And that's kind of mad
They're so slick when they move forward. I know that it's not been perfect between Vinny and Mbappe, and that they're trying to figure out.
You talk about Mbappe's goal. Is that the most ridiculous goal you've ever seen?
It's a fun one. It's obviously like he's shanked it off his shin.
He scored with his ACL.
But he's there and it's gone in. So whatever.
He was laughing afterwards, and it really did make me laugh. Like the way he gave a look, me like, whoop.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be there.
You've got to be there. Yeah, you've got to be there. And it's a great ball from Ceballos, actually.
And I just think that, this Real Madrid team, there is no way they don't score in that second leg. There's just no way. So that's why I see that this is virtually impossible for City to turn it around, because there's just not the form there to suggest that on the back of not only this, but in terms of getting turned over by Arsenal recently, 5-1, by getting turned over by PSG, 4-2, big moments, even, you know, let's go back to losing to United, big moment in their season to lose that one at the death. Even if City were leading at the Bernabeu with 5 minutes left, they'll lose. They'll lose. They won't do it.
I mean, if they're winning 3-0, they might not. But if they're winning by a goal, you would not back them at this point to see it out,
no,
especially against.
There's
this
no way they'll be 3-0 up. But yeah, fair point.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a tough ask now for Manchester City. But you know, it was a bit like this game, and I saw Joe Cole speaking about it yesterday on the TNT broadcast afterwards, and he was like, "Look, they need a moment to galvanize their season." Some people thought it would be this week. Some people, you know, have put it at various games in the last couple of weeks. Maybe it'll be the Bernabeu, and it was sort of like you said it, and then there was no conviction in that statement, mate.
That's not true, because we've seen it. We've seen them have their moments when they scored 6 at Ipswich, or when they beat Chelsea 3-1, or that they get a result. You're like, oh, maybe this is where they're turning the corner. What was it? When they beat West Ham 4-1 and then straight on the back of that, they scored 8 against Salford. And you're like, okay, they're getting their mojo back. Here we go. And then they come crashing down and they'll concede 4 against someone or 5 against someone. And because that is happening so often, the amount of goals this team scores as Premier League reigning champions from 4 years in a row is absolutely ludicrous. And so, I think that's easy to say. There's just no evidence there that would be the case.
No, I think you're right. I think that's it, right? Like, there's part of me that goes, yeah, but like, it's City, they'll work it out. But the evidence in front of my face tells me that they won't.
They're just not the same anymore, yeah.
Well, that's it. And I think we kind of can sit here and say, well, I don't see a world where City progress from this tie. Like I said, I think they'd be very long odds with the bookies now to actually end up going through. Like, I would like to sit here and be like, yeah, I think there's hope. And even with that, you kind of look at it and go, but that was a decent performance for like long periods of it. And yet they've still lost the game. And that's where I think I'm struggling to find anything to grip onto if you're a City fan to go, yeah, we could turn this around you know, between the legs.
I mean, and then they'll, you know, they go out and then their next battle is, well, make sure you're in the Champions League next season, because then it literally is about making sure you're in the top five from the Premier League. And at the moment, they're in that fifth spot, but they've got big competition from Newcastle just below them and possibly even the likes of Bournemouth and Aston Villa. So really, really testing times these for City, and they're going to need to hope that Nico Gonzalez and Omar Mamouche and Kusunov, these players do make an impact in the second half of the season, because they really, really need it.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd put a bet on who was going to score their first City goal, you know, who was going to score first, Kusunov or Marmoush, you'd have got long odds on Kusunov, wouldn't you? But alas, that's where we're at. Right, okay, let's come on to the other games that happened on Tuesday night. And actually, I was going to go here to Juve against PSV first, but I'm not, because I'm going to go to PSG instead, who won 3-0 at Brest. Now, this result shouldn't shock anyone, because PSG are unbeaten against Brest in their last 31 games between each other. Their last defeat happened in 1985. So I don't think anyone was too shocked that PSG came out victorious here. But the way that they played in this game, the swagger and the confidence that is flowing through PSG right now, I said this to you last night. I'm going right back to my prediction from the top of the year. I feel like if they're playing like this, there are very, very few teams that can stand against them. And I'm not sitting here and saying that the Brest are an unbelievable unit and that they actually, you know, have the defense to stand against this. But some of the stuff that PSG do is absolutely irresistible. The first goal that Dembele scores, where he cuts off the flank and drills it home like a reverse into the near post. No keeper in the world saves that. I don't care if it's Marco Bizzo or Thibaut Courtois. They are not saving that. And the way he is playing, 18 goals in his last 11 players, he is the hottest player, not just in Europe, but in the world right now, Ousmane Dembele, the least consistent player in world football, has weirdly in the last 2 months become the most consistent player in world football. What he's putting together is sublime. And suddenly, this front three that are dovetailing in and out of each other, no matter if it's Kvara or Barkala, well, it's always Dembele, but if it's Kvara or Barkala or Désiré Doué alongside him, they're dancing around teams. Vitinha's penalty to open the scoring here is so swaggerish. Like, he literally is like dirt off my shoulder kind of stuff, the way that he puts that away. And suddenly, that midfielder running games, suddenly the experience at the back of Kimpembe, Luke Hernandez has come back in here. Donnarumma is the weak link. And I think that we maintain that, and that maybe until that gets fixed or until he finally comes up trumps, that remains the place where you still always worry about PSG, but they look really, really hot. And suddenly everything seems to have clicked under this Luis Enrique system.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one actually that I've seen the least of from Tuesday's games. I just saw the raw highlights, but in fact, we were recording, weren't we, as this game was being played. But we noticed that they'd gone ahead through Vitinha. We talked about the fact that that midfield combination and the players that they've got to choose from, they are pretty special. And I don't think there are many teams that have got that at the moment across Europe. I think that we keep seeing teams being left short in the centre of the field. So PSG have really got that going for them. Now, obviously, once you get into it and you start judging them against Liverpool and teams like that, then we'll really see what they're made of. But whether it would be, like we've just been talking about Real Madrid and Man City, if you were to put this PSG midfield up against them, I think they'd be, well, I mean, we have seen the PSG midfield up against Man City, but it's just got a superiority about it. And I think that is what's going to help them. And the fact that they've got on, won the first leg 3-0, like, that's more confidence for them. That means that they can go and actually enjoy the second leg, which not many teams are going to be able to do this time. And they know they've already got one foot into the knockouts, and they can really relax, because we've just done a show on the title races. We've said there isn't really a title race to be had in France, and there's nothing really to look at here anymore because PSG are through.
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right. Just as we said, you know, there are confidences in knowing that Real Madrid with a lead are probably going to go see it out. There is no world where Brest beat PSG 3-4-0. Like, it just doesn't exist.
It would be great,
So they're through to the round of 16. It's going to be interesting to see what their pathway looks like, but I don't think anyone was going to want to come up against this side with the form that they're currently in. And as you say, they're going to be able to rest and rotate in the league. If they do get to the sharp end of this competition, they're going to be able to hone this team for, you know, those semi-finals, finals, if they get there. And I think that should worry everyone else, because, you know, you look at the title races, it could go to the wire in Spain, it could go to the wire in Italy. Maybe Liverpool have a similar vibe, but, you know, they obviously dropped points tonight as well. So I'm intrigued to see how this shakes out, but very, very convincing from PSG yet again. Convincing too from Borussia Dortmund. They were very good in the second half in their 3-0 win at Sporting. Again, I don't see Sporting going and winning by more than three at the Westfalenstadion. No. Even if Dortmund have been poor at home, there's probably a little bit more in this one, in that neither side have been particularly good. But Dortmund, when they step into European competitions, seem to have a whole different vibe to what they do when they play in the Bundesliga. Obviously, we saw them lose 2-1 to Stuttgart at the weekend. And then Niko Kovac getting his first win here. Serge Gyurassy, top scorer in the Champions League now. He's got 10 in the competition so far, which is remarkable. But yeah, it all came in a sort of like 20-minute spell where they really took the game by the scruff of the neck, and Sporting just kind of fell apart, to be honest. They'd started the game quite well, and then it kind of really just got away from them in the second half. And Karim Adeyemi getting on the score sheet as well to kind of wrap this one up and wrap it up as a tie was quite nice to see as well. But yeah, I mean, look, Borussia Dortmund seemed to be able to turn it on in European competitions. And last year, they were pretty poor in the Bundesliga as well. And then they ended up with some massive victories and ending up in a Champions League final, which, you know what, on balance, they were, you know, if Dortmund had won that game that came out, I think on balance, people would have been like, yeah, it's, you know, that's an okay result. I think it was one that could have gone either way. So, you know, the idea that they were that close to actually winning the whole competition last year, despite being poor in the Bundesliga, means that it's hard to write them off. Equally, you know, this is a Sporting side still getting used to its new manager, still very chaotic. When we talked about the title races on Tuesday's episode, we did kind of discuss the fact that all the teams in Portugal feel like they're a bit all over the place, and that's why the title race remains a bit exciting. And results like this, I think, show you why we put them up so high.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I had hope for Sporting early on, and I thought Konrad Harder was looking pretty dangerous. And I was like, obviously, he's got a hell of a shot on him. And I was really thinking that they might be able to make that breakthrough. The longer the game dragged on, the less it started to really look like they would be able to do that. And oh, it was pretty tough watch in the end by the time that Adeyemi stuck the third goal in and then celebrates with that ridiculous flip that he did. Even you could even his teammates, they're like, what are you doing? Like,
I did quite enjoy it.
Yeah, it was fun, but like, you're going to break your back, mate. So, yeah, and you could see even the relief on the Dortmund bench as the third went in particularly. It's like, even by our standards, surely this is job done. Like, even in the season that we're having, we can't mess this up. Now, is it plausible that Sporting can go to Dortmund and score three goals?
Not if they keep leaving Victor Gyökeres on the bench. They
might change that one. That's a bold move to leave Gyökeres out of the picture for a Champions League.
If they keep playing Zeno Dabast in centre midfield as well, then they're going nowhere, I'm afraid. Like, there are some very, very weird things going on at Sporting, and I do wonder if some of it is to do with players potentially leaving. You know, there are a couple of, you know, they had to play someone in central midfield because Morten Hjulmand was injured or not injured. He was suspended for this one. But Zeno DeBast did not feel like the option when they had Hidemasu Morita on the bench, when they had Daniel Braganza on the bench. I was kind of looking at it and thinking, really? That's what you've gone with here? That's what you've decided to actually run with? It didn't work. And ultimately Sporting have paid the price.
But they always concede, Dortmund. I mean, this is the first time in ages that they've managed to keep a clean sheet. So you've got to believe, as being Sporting, when like and with two good goal scorers in the team as well, that you can go out there and upset them. You've got to go 1-0 up. And I think that's a possibility for sure. But then it's about making sure that you don't then mismanage the rest of the game and throw too many bodies forward, because obviously Dortmund have definitely capabilities to eat you up on the counter.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's going to be a very, very difficult ask for this Sporting side as they remain in transition under their new manager. Right, the last game that happened on Tuesday was Juventus, who beat PSV Eindhoven 2-1 in what should have been the biggest USMNT off of all time. Tim Ware and Weston McKennie and Ricardo Pepi and Malik Tillman and then Serginho Dest and Richie Ledesma. There could have been six USMNT internationals on the pitch for this one. Sadly, we only got three. So, you know, there's a couple of players injured. Dest's been out for a while. Malik Tillman's been out for a while as well. And Ricardo Pepi now out for the rest of the season. So it wasn't quite the USMNT love-in that we had. But Weston McKennie did grab the headlines. A scorcher of an opener, Dean. And I've been longing to say this all day. I tweeted this. But this reminded me, there used to be on FIFA Street, this mode where when you built up enough skill points, you could press L1 and R1 together and it would unleash Game Breaker. And it basically meant that every shot just went in. It didn't matter. It just like rifled past the goalkeeper. Okay, yeah. And I was like, that's what Weston McKennie's just unleashed. He's just unleashed a Game Breaker in this moment. And it was almost like, you know, how that happens. I wanted MC Harvey doing the commentary on top of it. He'd be like, believe, what a goal. Like, that's exactly what you want over the top of that. So if anyone can do that for me, I'd be eternally grateful.
It felt like a really weird goal to me, yeah. Like, it was like...
Well, it's Federico Gatti just, like, marauding around in the box. I don't know what's going on.
I just couldn't get my head around the goal at all. I watched the game without knowing the score, so I managed to watch a rerun of this one, like, without knowing how it had ended, which was fun. But I was unmoved by this goal because I was just kind of in shock at like what had just happened, like the manner of it, the way it's fallen to him and the way he's just hit it. Like, was that just like a hit and hope? Did you really think that was that aimed there? I don't know. Obviously he gets his old wizard stick out or whatever he does with his celebration.
It's a wand, yeah.
But yeah, it was. I was pleased for him. Like I like Weston McKennie, and I do want him to do well. So I was glad that rifled into the roof of the net. But then I did fear for Juve as soon as it goes 1-1. I did fear for him.
And debut from old Lloyd Kelly, who was stuck out at left back after joining from Newcastle for 20-odd million pounds.
That's still one of the most bizarre signings of the January transfer window.
Yeah, it was not a left back. I know that he's been utilised there at times, especially when he was at Bournemouth, but like he feels like a centre-back that was shifted out to left-back, and he looks like a centre-back that had been shifted out to left-back here, turned inside out by old man Perisic, obviously former Inter player, who took his tally against Juve to just notched up another one. He's had an unbelievable record against Juventus, Ivan Perisic. I mean, look, it is great footwork and it's a nice finish, but you should never be being twined like that inside your own box. Mm. And you're right. I felt for Juve as well at this point. I really did fear that they were going to throw that away, and PSV with the side in the ascendancy. One thing changed the game at that point, and that was the introduction of Chico Conceição on the right-hand side, who flipped the script, who was absolutely sensational. And this is what he has in his locker. Every time he comes onto the pitch, he goes at players, he makes things happen. And yes, he loses the ball sometimes. Yes, he makes mistakes sometimes. But I tell you what, he opens up games because nobody knows what he's going to do next. And the way that he gets the byline here for the winner that eventually gets turned in by Mbangula, well, the first time he's saved them this season, I thought was pure Conceição, and it was absolutely glorious to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's a big result to actually get it over the line in the end. I still don't know, mate. I still don't know which way this one's going, because I think there's still a lot to be
said. Good tie. Yeah. Good tie. I like these. You know, we've talked a lot about ties that we don't think are going to have any turnarounds in them up to this point. This feels like the one with the most on the line going into next week.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
second legs. So, yeah, I mean, look, I thought Weston was good. I thought Tim Weah was actually excellent from right back. I thought he put in a really, really good shift for Juventus in this one. And Douglas Luiz, who was obviously rumoured to be leaving throughout the January window, I thought, you know, was quite impressive.
He's fighting, isn't he? He's fighting for his future.
He is. So, yeah, I thought that Juve probably just about deserved it in the end, but that period between the PSV equaliser and the fact and when they took back the lead will really, really worry Thiago Motta because they completely lost control of the game. All right, that's it for Tuesday's action. When we come back after the break, we're going to be discussing everything that went down on Wednesday. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Ranks FC. Jack, you have just watched, well, you're sat here actually in a Celtic shirt, so no bias here. Celtic against Bayern Munich, you've been taking it in. You've been, I'm sure, trying to remain very neutral, but it was Celtic 1, Bayern Munich 2. That late goal does feel important. Like when it was 2-0, I was like, oh, that's dead. But as soon as the other goal popped up, I was like, oh, here we go. There's a sign of life. What was it like? Were they dominated? Was there any reason to believe that they can go to one of the toughest places in Europe and actually come out with a shot win?
It was a really fun game, actually, in a strange kind of way, despite the fact that the Bayern dominated possession. Celtic thought they had the lead within 30 seconds. Niklas Kühn, who's obviously former Bayern player, cutting inside off that right wing and firing a shot in. And it's basically Adam Eder's in an offside position. But Manuel Neuer definitely can't dive until the ball comes past him. So I think it's a pretty reasonable decision to disallow that goal. It was amazing, though, that the roar around Celtic Park when they thought they'd taken the lead against Bayern after 30 seconds was absolutely unbelievable. Obviously chalked off for VAR. And it felt like Bayern took a little while to get settled into the game and that Celtic were causing them problems on the break. But Bayern had all the ball. Right, like they had all of the possession. They were sort of camped towards the edge of the Celtic box. And to be honest, I thought Celtic defended really, really well in the first half. Bayern sort of probing, but not finding loads of joy. And then they get the breakthrough right on the stroke of half time. And Michael Olise just finds a bit of space and thumps one in.
What a strike
from outside the box. I mean, it's an unbelievable strike, but it's also the kind of killer thing if you have been the home team and you've put in a really solid defensive display that's not just limited the opposition to, you know, it wasn't necessarily pot shots, but, you know, Celtic would kind of force Bayern backwards as they were trying to probe into the box and it would go back all the way back to Manuel Neuer. And, you know, the crowd were loving that. So after a defensive display in the first half that you've had to be pretty solid, you've had to be quite compact and you're feeling really good about yourselves because you haven't allowed big chances to be created. Suddenly Michael Olise just pulls that out of the onion bag and you're like, all right, cool. No, there's absolutely nothing we can do about that goal. And it changed the dynamic of the game. Obviously, Harry Kane adds a second and that is woeful defending on Celtic's part. They, you know, they leave him completely unmarked at the back stick and he volleys home, says thank you very much. Against his former teammate, Kasper Schmeichel. They were teammates at Leicester in 2013, which is just kind of wild, really. But Harry Kane scored a lot of goals against Kasper Schmeichel, both on the club and international stage since that point. So he should be used to it for a little while. But then it all got a little bit tasty, you know, so it kind of came out of their shell a little bit. They went for it. I think they should have had a penalty. It would have been slightly soft, but you've definitely seen them given, especially in the Champions League. And to be honest, we'll come on to Club Brugge later, but if that Club Brugge penalty is a penalty against Atalanta, then this is Stonewall, as far as I'm concerned. There's far more in this than there is in that Atalanta one. So that was a little bit frustrating, but so it kept plugging. And then Dyson Maeda goes round Manuel Neuer and screws it across the face of goal. And a couple of minutes later, he nods one in to give them some hope. And look, Neuer had to make a couple of really good saves towards the end of this to keep the lead. I mean, I did say, and I said this earlier on the radio, that I thought Celtic might get a result at Celtic Park tonight. I said that I didn't think they would probably come out of this tie having progressed. And they gave it a really good go. It was a really good battle, but I think they really needed to have something to hang on to in Munich if they were gonna turn this around. I don't think this Bayern side are perfect. I think they have flaws and structural weaknesses that can be exploited. I wonder if Celtic will look to hit them on the break a little bit more when it comes, you know, into this second leg and try and get the likes of Dyson Maeda into the game. slightly more. Maybe Jota will be fit to go from the start by that point. But I think that the damage is probably done from this one. Although that shouldn't take away from what was a very spirited Celtic performance. Bayern did what they needed to do. They got the job done.
I saw an interview with Harry Kane afterwards, and he admitted he couldn't believe that he was unmarked in the 6-yard box.
Nor could I.
He was like, they were like, could you believe it? He was like, if I'm honest, no, I couldn't believe it. Like, how have you, like, what has happened there? Like, you just said they've defended well, yet they've...
They had. Just a complete mix up. Like,
oh, yeah, just a complete mix up. Brendan Rodgers must be like, what? There was no part of our game plan that suggested we should be doing this.
I think there's also kind of doubled down on, because obviously you go in at the break and you're all a little bit frustrated that this goal has gone in. It's a wonder strike from Michael Olise. Not much you can do about it. And then you're like, all right, we don't concede again. And within 10 minutes, you've left Harry Kane unmarked in the 6-yard box. You're like you're right. Brendan Rodgers pulling his hair out, I imagine. Yeah. But yeah, it's just a defensive slip. And I think people will watch the highlights and be like, wow, so it must have been at sixes and sevens. They weren't. Like, for the majority of the game, that is a slip. It was obviously a costly slip, but it was a singular mistake rather than, you know, looking at it from a cohesive whole.
Interesting, so, yeah.
I think it's probably just worth pointing out. Right, shall we take it onwards to... Where did you watch? You watched Feyenoord's win over Milan, where there was also a costly defensive slip.
Yeah, I mean, it started really well, this game. Milan were on the attack. It looked like they were going to score. And then seconds later, the ball's in the back of their own net. It proves to be the only goal of the game. I struggled to say his name, but Igor Paschal. Scores the only goal of the game. And he hits one, and like talking earlier on about the rain and stuff, it's difficult conditions this game was played in. It's skipped up. Maignan should have done better, but didn't. And it's in the back of the net. But ultimately, Milan have got 87 minutes to turn that around and come back from it. And they never really showed enough intent to do that. It was a pretty end-to-end game, and there were chances on both sides. I thought Feyenoord did a good job of keeping a control of their game plan, because if they had lost focus, there was the potential they could have become exposed. But they didn't do that. And I think it was partly helped by the fact that Milan didn't seem that focused in attack, to be honest. Now, in the CBS coverage here...
The Santi Jimenez factor of it all.
Well, yeah. We'll get to him in a sec. Like, heard Mika Richards afterwards saying he thought that João Felix had a good game. I mean, I don't know if he only had one eye on it, but I don't really agree with that. On the ball at times, yeah, like you would always expect from João Felix, but too much time. Like, he was spent arguing with Feyenoord players who he clearly was, it seemed like, genuinely felt like he was looking down on them. And he kept getting into a rows with the goalkeeper. His work rate for me didn't quite cut it. I really want João Felix to make a success of this move, as I've talked about before. Like, I want this to be the one for him. Feel at home and do it. But just felt a little bit let down by him. Not as let down as I felt from Rafa Leão, who I have big problems with right now. And I think he was the most disappointing player on this pitch again. Like, Milan clearly felt like the left side was going to be their strength in this game. So,
as it has been for so many years.
As a result of that, they barely tried the right flank. They was all down the left for Teo and Rafa Leão whenever they could. But Leão's just like so lackadaisical at the moment. And even when he gets into the box, he's looking like he's going to go. It feels like he's looking to go down rather than actually get a shot away. Like, we're back to that Leão. And I don't know why. Like, he really annoys me, because I do love his style of play, and I've loved seeing him become a superstar type player. But this was one of his really frustrating ones. And it annoyed me that when Pulisic was dragged on the hour mark, that it was Pulisic that was going off, to be honest, because he had the work rate. He was getting back to try and help Kyle Walker, but he was also obviously got that goal threat too. So unless Pulisic had a knock there, then I'm surprised that he was the one that came off. Obviously, Santi Jimenez, there was a lot of talk about him going back to Netherlands and stuff. didn't really cut it. You know, he got a decent reception as he left the pitch in the end. Yeah, that all seemed quite amicable as he eventually left the field. But yeah, it all just felt a bit meh for Milan. And Sergio Conceição has now got a problem. He's, you know, for everything that Pioli went through, and when they bring in managers in at AC Milan, really got to live up to the hype, and you've got to talk a good game, but then play a really entertaining game too. And I know Pioli went up and down when he was there, and they've, you know, come through Fonseca and stuff since then. But I'm just not sure that this is going in the right direction quick enough. Because when we get to the second leg, the expectation will be that because Milan are at home, that they are actually not too badly off here, because they're only 1-0 down and they will score.
But ties if Milan, in balance at 1-0 to the away team, isn't it?
Half if time, Milan that's don't 0-0. Score early in that second leg, I think they're going out, because I expect Feyenoord to set up exactly as they did here, not to give anything away, not to lose, and they will get chances to hit them on the break. And Milan really did struggle to deal with pace at times. I mean, we know Kyle Walker's been undone numerous times in the Premier League. That's why he's ended up in Italy in the first place. And Kyle Walker was a little bit of sixes and sevens in this one. Again, I mean,
Paschal's a really, really good player, by the way.
Like, Paschal's really good. And he's really nimble, right? He can really turn people.
He's picked up a lot of assists in this competition already this season. I think he had the most goal involvements for Feyenoord behind Santi Jimenez in the league stage. So clearly someone who's having a real impact, but he's grown into this team. He's been there for a number of years now, and it's been nice to watch him grow, you know, into this side to become a key player for them. He can cause real problems. And Haji Musa on the other side is a good footballer too. Like, this is a decent Feyenoord side, but they've been in a really bad moment. Like, they fired their manager on Monday. Brian Priska was fired as the Feyenoord manager. They've got an interim boss in Pascal Boskjaert for the time being. I mean, for them to have gone and, okay, maybe there's a bit of new manager bounce, et cetera, just a bit of freedom. But it is a weird thing that Milan didn't look at that as a real opportunity. They didn't see blood in the water, considering where Feyenoord were, considering there was a lot of question marks in the Dutch press about not whether it was the right decision necessarily to fire Brian Priska, but to do it at that point, especially after they won at the weekend in the Rotterdam derby against Sparta. So you kind of look at that from that perspective and think, well, Milan had come out hot here, there would have been a real opportunity to dig in. But, you know, in front of De Kuyp, who would have looked at this as a huge game, that the season's pretty much up in terms of the Eredivisie, they're not going to catch the top two there. This feels like it, and they're out of the Beker as well. They're out of the Dutch Cup. They got knocked out by PSV. So the Champions League is kind of, they can throw everything at it and see how far they can get along. There's a bit of a free hit in that regard, but yeah, I also find it weird that Milan weren't able to find a way here. And, you know, you are looking at some of these players, you know, after Tammy Abraham performed so well in those couple of games, obviously Santi Jimenez scored at the weekend, right? And he put a brilliant assist on off the bench for the game before that for Joao Felix. But equally, I do feel a bit for Tammy, because he came into the side at a moment where they were a bit all over the place with Morata leaving and Jimenez coming in. And he hadn't had that many opportunities. He scores a couple of goals and then suddenly he's straight back on the bench. And you got to feel that, you know, when he's coming on with 8 minutes to play here, he must be like, hang on. Yeah. I've just put in those shifts for you and I've suddenly been dropped straight back out of it. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, that is a fair point. Yeah, it's not enough time really to make his mark on a game like this. But I think Feyenoord will really fancy the second leg, if I'm honest with you. But as I say, and if Milan don't go and score in the first 20 minutes of that game, then they could really be on upset watch.
It could really get ugly, I think, in terms of actually a game plan. And that's the thing that you start to be like, oh God, where's this going to go? How's it going to kind of shake off? So we'll see. Right. There were two other games as well. There was another shock in that another Italian side fell to opposition from a Northern European, Northwestern European League. Oh, I'm really stretching here a little bit, but there is always that thing about Benelux, right? And the fact that Belgium and the Netherlands and Luxembourg might have combined their leagues at one point. So another Benelux side in Club Brugge winning 2-1 against Atalanta. I got to say, I feel a bit for Gasperini here. There isn't a world ever where this is a penalty that Club Brugge get in the 93rd minute to actually go and win the game. And it's put away really nicely, credit where it's due in terms of how the game shook out. But equally, it's just not a penalty in any world. Isaac Hien, you know, basically brushes the striker's face with his arm. It goes down and the ref gives it. And the VAR, because there is contact, decides they're not going to overturn it. But I think Gasperini said after the game, you could ask 100 people if that's a penalty. And he didn't say one person. He was like, and 100 of them will say no penalty. So he was pretty convinced on it. I thought Martin de Rome spoke really well after this game, actually. Interestingly, just basically coming out and saying, look, it's not a penalty, but we weren't good enough. We need to be better. We will have to, you know, address the second leg and we have to look at it now. And Gasperini said it's going to be hard, right? Because they're going to have to open up. Same as you're talking about with this final, you know, and Milan thing. Atalanta are going to have to open up a little bit in that second leg and be able to kind of kick onwards. And that's going to leave spaces. And Ferran Yükle took advantage of that in the first half. I really like Ferran Yükle. I've been banging on about him for ages. And I think that someone's going to take a gamble at some point because he's a really nicely complete forward. Atalanta dragged themselves back into it with a Pasalic goal, but I don't think they did enough. Considering the firepower was on the pitch, considering, and again, another ex-player derby in Charles de Ketelaere going back to his first club, coming in there and not really making a huge impact. Retegi, who scored 4 goals at the weekend against Hellas Verona, not making a huge impact. Yes, Atalanta are missing key players in the shape of Ademola Lookman, etc., but there was still enough talent on the pitch to play better than this. And I thought they looked really kind of, they looked just a bit flat, considering this feels like a real opportunity for them to go far in this competition.
Yeah, it was an interesting result. And I honestly just assumed that Atalanta went there and came away with at least a 1-goal lead, probably a 2-goal lead, because I didn't think they would let an opportunity like this pass them by. But fair play. I mean, you've got to hand it to Brugge for actually going out and making sure that that wasn't going to be the case. And
they've been tough to beat all campaign. You know, we go back to the first episode of Champions League Takeaway this year, and they lost to Dortmund. And I said they were unlucky to lose that game and that they're going to give a load of teams a decent contest over the course of this Champions League. So I'm glad that's right. But I thought this Atalanta side in particular would have enough firepower to kind of burst through that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, obviously, there was the Man City game not long ago, and Brugge were winning that game, right? They'd really rattled Man City at the Etihad.
And they had their chances even at 1-1, right?
Yeah, exactly. And before that, there was the Juve game as well, which ended goalless, but, you know, they're competing with these teams. So I don't know, I haven't seen it yet, but maybe Atalanta had a superiority complex and they just felt that they were almost entitled. And Atalanta, like, they're obviously not giants of European football at this stage, but they have suddenly earned a lot of respect. And I think that they're starting to have an expectation level of themselves that they will win. And I'll be interested to go back and watch this one and just see how they dealt with it, because they can't start thinking like that if that's how they've got to here. Obviously, like, they were very close to getting a draw. Like, it's gone literally into added time. But they'll still
have their chances as well, right? Lazar Samardzic, like, slots wide when he's one-on-one with the keeper. There were opportunities. There was a good strike from De Ketelaere from outside the box that was dealt with well by the keeper. Atalanta grew into the game after quite a slow start. And they got better, but it just, again, it just felt like they were a little bit flat, if they were a little bit lacking. And that was not what I was expecting to see from a Gasperini team. So, yeah, the work to do, major work to do for Atalanta. I think that could be a very, very interesting second leg. One that probably won't be quite as interesting is Monaco against Benfica, because Benfica won away at Monaco 1-0. Another goal for Vangelis Pavlidis, Dean, and another lovely goal for Vangelis Pavlidis. Beautiful chip over the keeper to finish this off. Like, you know, one of those where the keeper's going down and he just sort of like dinks him as he's running in. Really, really nice from Vangelis Pavlidis. He's got a good record in this competition now after what was a slow start at Benfica. Monaco were reduced to 10 men. Almasrati was sent off for a second yellow card. just feels like Monaco are lacking a bit of cutting edge. Mika Bieres started up front. He came in January because Flo Balogun is injured at the moment and is not able to lead that line. And just Brill and Bolo felt a little bit flat in this one. There's a couple of players here you're looking at and going, they could really just do with a little bit more spark in the final third at the moment, Monaco, that they're on a little bit of a wobbly run of form. And Benfica took full advantage of it. You know, they've been the best side of the Portuguese big three in the last month. They've performed well in Europe in some big games. Obviously, they lost that big game to Barcelona. Then they fell to Casapia in the league. But since then, they've really rattled back and kind of had a few good performances. One, obviously, to qualify for this playoff. And then also in domestic matters as well. They've been pretty smooth in the couple of games since then. And another big win for them. They go back to the Estadio de Luz with a 1-0 lead. I fancy Benfica to probably see this Monaco side off unless we see a drastic turnaround in form in the next couple of days.
Do you? Yeah, that's interesting.
They've beaten Monaco already in the Champions League this season now because they met in the league stage. They won 3-2 in Monaco on that occasion. Now they've won 1-0 in this one. I just think that they'll probably get the job done.
Yeah, I mean, they've been on a decent run at the moment. Benfica obviously beat Juve as well in the Champions League recently. So
yeah.
They'll have a certain sense of confidence, I think, that they could go and complete that.
Well, also, if they were to win this, they've got a 1-in-2 chance of coming up against Barcelona again. And we all know that means fireworks. So that might be fun. Just one to keep an eye on from the narrative perspectives. But congratulations to Benfica. A job well done in the Principality. And with that, we're going to call this to a close. All that's left for me to do, say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. Thank you so much for listening, as ever, to this Champions League takeaway on Ranks FC. The truth returns on Friday. Sam and Doogie are back in the building, and they're talking about Simone Inzaghi, the Inter manager, and whether he's the most underrated manager in European football. So a nice one to get our teeth stuck into there on Friday ahead of the weekend and ahead of a massive game for Inter this weekend away at Juventus in the Derby d'Italia. So nicely timed from that perspective. But from us, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for sticking with us this week across both of these episodes. And we'll see you all very shortly. Take it easy, Rank Squad. Peace.